I'll share a few observations and thoughts on selected macroeconomic and social developments in South Africa over the past 15 years. As it has already been mentioned, as of the 9th of November, I will duly retire to my little property in Limpopo and try and grow avocado fruits. And as such, I might no longer be in a position to make any commentary on monetary policy. I therefore take full advantage of this platform to remind all of us about some home truths, one of which is that no central bank worthy of its salt can ever tolerate high inflation. And this should be the case in particular when some in our society think that the louder they shout, the more the truth about what they shout about. Price stability may not be a sufficient condition, but I maintain here this evening that it is a necessary condition for sustained economic growth and prosperity. I'd like to think that Stephen Bantu Biko would have been somewhat happy to see the fairly contained pace of inflation over the past 15 years, knowing fully the dire consequences of inflation for the poor, those who are unable to hedge against inflation. I'm happy to note that since 1994, average headline inflation has amounted to approximately 6.5% per annum. Over the preceding 15 years, i.e. 1979 to 1994, headline inflation had averaged 14% per annum. Inflation has been uneven over the period, though, induced typically by significant changes in key exogenous drivers of inflation, such as oil prices. Secondly, the recent strike action has led some commentators to describe this as a winter of discontent. You can tell that anybody who writes about the winter of discontent has got a lot of English influence. I do not particularly share that view. My experience since 1994 in particular is that strike action during this time of our calendar is a seasonal issue. When I became Minister of Labor in 1994, some of the commentators used to say that the October Revolution was on its way because of the number of strikes that occurred. There was no such thing as an October Revolution. There was a contest for the distribution of surplus between business and labor. However, what is important is that whatever level of wage settlements are reached, these should always be compensated by productivity gains, lest we push inflation higher. Though I wish to mention some issues about the labor market later, I do need to refer briefly to the labor legislation over the past 15 years. And I've been very good to the Minister of Labor. I haven't spoken about labor matters for a long time, so you'll forgive me. There are some commentators who argue that South Africa's labor market regime is rigid and inflexible. As the country's first post-apartheid Minister of Labor, some of the blame has been pointed in my direction, needless to say. I'm the first to admit that some of the things that could have been, which were put in place, could have been done differently. To grant the requisite rights to organize, and also in the event where there's a fundamental dispute, the right to strike, or for employers to lock out, a right which the employers seem not to have been able to exercise for one reason or the other. But the rights which are enshrined in the Labor Relations Act are balanced with the responsibilities. The other piece of legislation that is normally referred to as inflexible is the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. Incidentally, when we were drafting this set of laws, we had intended to start off with the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. But time was not on our side. The Basic Conditions of Employment Act is unavoidable in any country. And in our situation, we had to ensure that there are basic protections that are extended to working people. In particular, the most vulnerable and the unorganized. I know there are certain sections that the trade union movement never liked during the negotiations process. For example, there's a clause called the variation of labor conditions. And I recall the trade union movement during negotiations saying that they agreed in principle with variation of conditions of employment for as long as the variations were not downwards. So you can vary the standard anywhere, but can't vary downwards. So I recall asking Mbazi Mashiloa, who was General Secretary of COSATU at the time, how can you vary something downward? He says, no, you don't know these employers. They will seek to weaken the basic rights. So let's agree there's a concrete floor. So you can't go down. So I thought, wow, this is interesting. I wonder if he still argues the same position today. The other piece of legislation was the Employment Equity Act, which requires no defense at all. The Employment Equity Act was meant in particular to break down those racial barriers that we find in the workplace. And I must emphasize again today that the philosophical foundation was that all those who have been discriminated against before, whether they're black, they're women, or white women, are included in the Employment Equity Act. And those of us who have been practitioners in the field of the workplace will tell you that white women were discriminated against. In the bank, for example, I found that white women were excluded from the pension fund for many years, not allowed to be part of the pension fund. I know that there's one who has recently been appointed Director General of the Department of Labor who disagrees with me, but it's a civilized disagreement. And finally, the Health and Safety, Occupational Health and Safety Act was very important at the time, still important today, to try and defend working people from unhealthy, unsafe work environments. So, yes, here and there, maybe we might have gone overboard, but this basic framework, I think, was correct. All that's required is consistent political leadership in the implementation. Again, to break with tradition, let me say a few things about what I think are the social ills which are consuming not just South Africa, but many other parts of the world. We witnessed last year here in South Africa the xenophobic tendencies which shamed our country. Some might indeed exclaim, oh, beloved country, what would Steve Biko have said about all of this? At the height of the attacks on non-South African citizens, in brackets, even some South African citizens who were thought not to be South Africans, most of us were most notable by our absence our silence and inaction. Whether in that silence, absence, and inaction, one was to read that we approved of what was happening, or we were afraid, were cowards, or that for as long as those things occurred far away from where I was, it was okay. But the judgment is there upon all of us South Africans as to why we allowed these xenophobic tendencies to emerge. But having lived outside South Africa for many years personally, I can tell you that xenophobia is a worldwide problem. I recall in some countries where I lived, we used to be told things like refugees are responsible for the introduction of HIV and AIDS in the particular societies. Bamaxula trata, those who jump fences. That if there's an increase in the crime rate at any particular point in time, you blamed it on the non-citizens. And all the negative things you blamed on non-citizens. It's a scourge that needs to be fought throughout the world. In fact, I have a personal hatred for the word foreigner. Because for many years I was called a foreigner, and it is not nice to be called a foreigner. In the vocabulary of the South African Reserve Bank, I have tried to illegalize the use of the word foreigner. So when we have to speak about, the staff will say technically foreign inflows of capital. I say no, it's international flows. The word foreign, there's something unnice about it. And I think it has an impact on many people's behavior. Now, xenophobic tendencies in Southern Africa are a complete negation of our attempts to accelerate economic integration. We have ideas of establishing a free trade area by 2008, by the which we have, but nobody notices. A customs union by next year. A common market and monetary union by 2015 and 2016, respectively. If indeed we are to achieve these objectives, it therefore means that our own psychological makeup towards our own fellow brothers and sisters must be different. If we are to harmonize and rationalize and pull our resources together, we can only do so in the spirit of sister and brotherhood. And indeed, we have gone so far at the level of central banks as to design payment and settlement systems which ensure that all regional systems talk to one another. We've developed common legislation governing banks, and even went to the extent of drafting a common central bank law. Now, Steve Biko observed that the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Indeed, the liberation of the oppressed is not only political, economic, and social, but involves psychological liberation as well. Can we claim to have liberated our minds when the daily statistics of rape and other forms of violence against women and children leave us questioning the very essence of our humanity? Can we indeed say we have liberated ourselves when we seem to take pride in littering around our environment? Can we say that we have liberated ourselves when, in complete contradiction to the cultural history of our society, people get married, no accommodation, and they mobilize each other to demand housing from the government? And yet, in our culture, when a young man goes to see his father and says, "Dad, I want to get married," first question is, where is your wife going to stay? You build a house first, then you go and marry. You cannot say, "Come, wifey, let's go in toy toy, demand a house from another man." What nonsense is this? Can't be correct. I know that Archbishop Tutu has put it very well when he says, and I quote, "What has come over us." Perhaps we did not realize just how apartheid had damaged us, so that we seem to have lost our sense of right and wrong. And then he goes on to make all kinds of examples of what has gone wrong. And that kind of what has gone wrong still continues today. Archbishop Tutu made reference to municipal workers who, when they go on strike, protected by that legislation we spoke about earlier, they trash the streets. They chase away the people who are trying to make a living selling goods informally, break windows, and cause unnecessary mayhem. And today you have a most unbelievable situation where when the authorities are trying to revive the transport system in our communities, to revolutionize the interconnected systems of transport, the taxi people say, "No, you can't do that. Because, quote, we own the intellectual property of the routes." Now, I don't know what has happened to intellectual property. I thought that when you have generated something as your intellectual property, you go and register that with the relevant department. So you can say, "Indeed, here is my intellectual property." How can a road that you did not build be your intellectual property? It can't. And the notion that if I do not get my way in a democracy, I'll resort to shooting other people is most definitely not in keeping with what we should be. The very idea that some health professionals can abandon the sick who are in dire need of attention because the clock has struck 4 p.m. is unthinkable. That teachers can abandon learners in favor of this or the other demand, usually very close to exams, is totally unacceptable. The fact that some have seen shopping malls as places where they go and rob and maim and kill, it's just not acceptable. The fact that some in the military, entrusted with the defense of our country and its constitutional order, can disobey the orders of their seniors and the court and choose to run riots near the Union Building, the seat of power, is totally unacceptable, whatever the nature of the grievances. So some might then exclaim, "Oh, beloved country, what would Steve Biko have said about all of these developments?" Now, he can't answer for himself. But from what we understand about what he stood for, you probably have said, "Let us regroup, let us analyze the situation, let us plot a better way forward, and take our country much further than it has done." Any review of the past 15 years involving the South African economy will reveal indeed that our assets and liabilities as a country are performing very well. As with any analysis of assets and liabilities, there will be some negative that will come across. Sometimes when I listen to the discourse in the country, or whatever one can call it, one might be left with the impression that this country is the worst performing in the world. And yet it's not true. I suppose when you are inside the country, you don't see as much of what has been achieved as compared to those who look from outside. But I know for certain that real gross domestic product per capita rose by some 28% from in 1994 to 2008. Quite a remarkable achievement. Now, it's very difficult to go and explain that to maybe the junior lecturer in the economics department, who is being overworked, maybe underpaid, to say that overall, this has been the improvement that we've seen. To say that there's been significant economic growth over the period, on average, about 5%. Yes, employment growth has not been in the manner that we had hoped to be. But nevertheless, there has been some success. But our economy has suffered more specifically from the lack of skills, a matter that occupies the brains here at university all the time, and I do not need to repeat. But the fact that the tertiary sector of our economy is now one of the dominant components of GDP indicates to us that we need a different mix of skills in order to go forward. And the fact that we are burdened with the legacy of the apartheid education system, where the significant majority of our people have no skills at all, it means that a significant number of our people will remain unemployed for a long time. That they might only be absorbed in public works programs and some such activity. But I think there are some warning signs on the wall. And these have to do with the fact that we are witnessing fewer and fewer of our school children passing their matric with mathematics. I indeed do not want to be a lecturer at first year in economics having to teach those students algebra and calculus, because I can imagine the difficulties that we're going through. I asked a rhetorical question the other day as to who are the people responsible for making sure that the aircrafts in which we travel do not collapse to the ground. In Johannesburg, there's some component at the airport called SAA Technical Services. is the people there who make sure that these planes don't collapse. Now, if I was to ask Biko Jr. here, as to how many black people work in that SAA Technical Services, is going to bite his tongue. Because they're not there. Very key and strategic. And a lot has to do with the lack of mathematics and other science education in our schools. All of us know that over the past 15 years, we've made major strides in improving the budget framework, revenue collection, and the appropriate spending patterns. Whereas in 94, there was a danger that South Africa was going to face, South Africa was going to face a debt trap that was avoided. And today, although we face the consequences of the economic recession, nevertheless, the decisions made in the past couple of years have stood us in good stead. The recession is deep and painful, but nevertheless, we're quite certain that we'll be able to sail through it. Our markets have become deep. The equity markets, the bond market, are all an envy of many an emerging market. A good foundation has been laid. Now, there are some unintended consequences of good things that have been made, one of which is the exchange rate. The fiscal position has improved. The markets are very strong. There has been a good performance on the part of the economy over the past 15 years. 2001, we had a currency crisis, and everybody, of course, pointed their fingers at the governor of the South African Reserve Bank. Today, the exchange rate has recovered, and again, a finger has been pointed at the governor because the manufacturing sector is unhappy. And mining. Oh, by the way, I must tell you a story. One of the most wonderful moments of my time in public life was when the National Union of Mine Workers, together with the Chamber of Mines, mobilized for a demonstration to the South African Reserve Bank together. So the bosses and the employees marched together to the South African Reserve Bank. They were both complaining about what they called the relative strength of the exchange rate. The chaps from the Chamber of Mines were wearing suits and ties, and the mine workers were wearing t-shirts, but they marched together. I was saying the consequence of our success sometimes has been reflected in the exchange rate. And from time to time, we've seen the exchange rate entering into a period of misalignment and causing a number of difficulties for us. Nevertheless, the foundation has been made. Let me conclude about the social issues very briefly. You know, South Africa has come a long way in terms of rebuilding and healing from the legacies of the apartheid system. We all recognize that a lot still needs to be done, and done responsibly. However, we can only learn by replicating what evidently works and reviewing and discarding what does not work. A clear message emerging from socio-economic trends in the post-apartheid period is that we should pay closer attention to policy implementation in terms of sequencing and understanding the complementarities between macroeconomic and social interventions. Most of us here, if we're woken up at night and asked, what will be the policy mix that you will put in place to make South Africa successful? You'll just rattle through the policy mix. There's no need for further research, really. Key issue is implementation. And more often than not, my observation is that the weaknesses in policy implementation have also to do with the skills mix or mismatches that we have on the part of the implementer. So it's all very good to talk about the fact that Cape Town might need a good road and transport network, but somebody must sort out what we do that junction there to make sure that we don't get stuck there all the time. It's just implementation of policy, good intention, but implementation. From the socioeconomic point of view, we can point out with pride that significant ground has been gained in improving the living conditions of many South Africans. After the turn of the century, the overall levels of poverty showed a definitive downward trend, albeit gradually. The proportion of the population living below the income and expenditure survey poverty line of 250 rand increased from 31% in 1995 to 38% in 2000, but then dipped thereafter to 23% in 2005. Similarly, the levels of inequality peaked in 2000 and began to decline somewhat thereafter. The total Gini coefficient rose from 0.7 in 1993 to 0.68 in 1999, before trending downwards to 0.66 in 2007. Of course, the inter and intra-racial trends, however, remain worrisome. Although inequality has eased somewhat since the year 2000, amongst Africans it remains the highest compared with other population groups. Furthermore, according to the All Media and Product Survey data, notwithstanding the low base, the share of income accruing to Africans marginally gained ground against that of other population groups, rising from nearly 32% to 39% over the 10-year period between 1994 and 2004. These trends are due more to the expansion of households receiving social grants. Whereas the year-on-year growth in welfare payments before the year 2000 averaged about 6%, it soared to 40.4% in 2001, thereafter decelerating somewhat to around 29% in 2005 and 3.4% in 2007. Now, I know from a political point of view, it's good to point out that the number of people benefiting from social welfare grants has improved. But from the point of view of the total development of the person, the dignity and consciousness that we talk about the person, is this the direction that we should be going? The total number of social grant beneficiaries expanded sixfold from 2.4 million in 1996 to 12.3 million in 2007. Now the question can be asked, should we not be thinking about consolidating the social grant system instead of over expanding just the number of recipients? I know I'm standing in front of academics, so I can't talk about urban legends lest I be crucified. But there are people in the townships who talk about the fact that I'm better off having a baby in order to get a grant. We don't want to talk about this because it's somewhat embarrassing. And in terms of the research that's there, it might be isolated incidents. But a number of people here can testify to that. I can take an opinion poll later. But those, of course, who are underprivileged must get support from all of us, but we must just be careful about the trend and the tendency. So as we celebrate the life and times of Steve Biko, as we celebrate the achievements we've made in our democracy, and as we look across the region and see the gains and difficulties that we experience, we have at least to be thankful that with all its weaknesses, our democratic system has served us well. And that our task is to go out and improve on it. And as I said at the beginning, let not those with the loudest voices intimidate you from confronting the truth. Thank you very much.